You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au. Welcome to the United States, land of the thief, home of the slave. Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and power is God.
You're tuned to Uprise Radio on Radical Radio 3CR. You might be on 855 AM on your radio or through 3CR Digital or your favourite podcast client. It is the last day of 2024, the last day of what's been a pretty shitful year. We're 15 months into a genocide. There's been massive political, military incursions internationally. And there's been a really intensified anti-genocide movement, as is necessary here in so-called Australia. We are recording here from the unceded lands of the Dja Dja Wurrung, and we're going to jump straight into it. Today's show is going to be the first in a few-part series, yet to be determined, looking at counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency as a military tactic that is employed and indeed determined and designed to be deployed not just against populations of countries that have been invaded, including First Nations people here, but also on broader populations in order to gain popular support. And I guess we're going to start today with a little bit of history of counterinsurgency, what it is, how it emerged, and how it's developed into the forms today. And as the series progresses in the coming weeks and months, we'll be examining how these tactics are utilised against the current anti-genocide movement. Now, in all of the reading and research that we have been doing, one thing's really stood out is that counterinsurgency is indeed a political movement, a political tactic, rather. And so I guess in our hopes for this series is keeping in mind that it's a political movement is understanding that that the politics of our movement is necessary in order to be less vulnerable to the tactics of counterinsurgency. So we're not here attempting to provide tactics or what that might look like, but I guess just have some ideas and some history and context for a springboard to take back to our movement, to our affinity groups, and points of discussion about how we can really be as prepared as we can be, and understand that, yes, repression, police repression, military repression, poverty, structural and political issues. And this is what really counterinsurgency seeks to gain legitimacy from by, I guess, coming in, sweeping in and having a raft of policies in which to appear to be sorting out those problems in order to gain popular support from the rest of the population, from a broader population, in order to counter insurgent movements or indeed anti-genocide movements. And so with that in mind, that's really these discussion points, I guess, of how we can think of being more prepared and less vulnerable to the state's tactics as it will continue to try through counterinsurgency, whether that be through the media, through the normalisation of the increased military build-up. But, yeah, let's get straight into it. But just before we do, I just want to frame, I guess, these ongoing discussions. And this is an interview conducted with Jay Sakai. And this is Jay Sakai in mid-2020. Questions of how to handle inherited ideologies and politics are important now. As a new generation of revolutionaries comes in onto the torn-up chaos landscape that is our 21st century. It's not so easy to understand as it's supposed to be. And it's really a deeper matter than if you've just joined Team Green New Deal or Team Social Democrat. As a whole, hard-won pieces of knowledge that revolutionaries put together in past tides of struggle to scrawl out a strategic map, and then hopefully a tactical guide, however tentative, are valuable, thought-provoking, with interesting hints, both positive and negative, of what was really thought about, really tried, yet are always being erased and forgotten, because they were never written in permanent ink in the first place, no more than we ourselves can be. We're always just for right then, though women and men never thought so. We are always receding deeper into memory as generations and the world itself turns. Even if saved in some unchristian holy text, they can only become gradually distant from their once sensuous context of immediate life and death class struggle, and thus are often now too faded to be easily read. That previous scientific knowledge, that theory and practice is so precious for us precisely because it keeps disappearing and has to be constantly repatterned and stitched together all over again. Every new generation must learn to apply revolutionary science themselves, rediscovering fire all over again, which is why the scraps of basic scientific theory we can hold on to against the tidal pull are so practically important. And yes, those pitfalls. Knowledge isn't something academic or abstract and made only by some intellectual elite. I believe that revolutionaries have to take studying and using theory very seriously, the good and the bad of it. On the deepest level, we all need theory to help give understandable order to the waves of disparate cries and mass explosions streaming across our receivers. But if revolutionary theory can be an invaluable tool, that doesn't mean that any given practitioner using the tool knows what they are doing. That's two very different things. The best roller chest of chrome snap-on tools is no help if the mechanic working on your car has only an uncertain idea of what the problem is, or is just faking it, which is infuriating but happens. Left theorists aren't any more scientific than auto mechanics, you know? Maybe it would be good to see how that idea side of our struggle has worked here, or hasn't, because failed left theory isn't rare either. It is a hard vagabond science to capture in a bottle. It humbles you, or it had better. And that's it in Jay Sakai speaking in mid-2020. And I guess we're just wanting to frame our ongoing discussions over the next coming weeks and months within that. And also within the thinking about the way that the military incursion, encroachment upon our everyday lives through the media, through school programs, through things like Avalon, through jacked up seemingly justified military spending on the basis of sovereign defense capability. And just something to keep in mind is an idea based off Deleuze and Guattari about weapons and targets. And I guess the dichotomy between weapons and targets is to weaponize something in view of hitting a target is to thus open oneself up to the risk of being targeted. And so, indeed, folks, that's what we must do. When they fire at us with their weapons, remember that they are opening themselves up as well. So, counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency, otherwise known as COIN, COIN, is a military tactic that has been employed for decades in different forms and has taken many different forms over the decades, from the French incursion and loss in Indochina, into the Vietnam War, into the French in the battle for Algeria against the FLN. Through the Cold War, counterinsurgency tactics have been refined and shifted, and then into Afghanistan and Iraq, where counterinsurgency was a huge part in what developed the military strategy of both the US and also the Australian Army's encroachment into Iraq and Afghanistan, and how the Australian Army's role in counterinsurgent movements. But yeah, one common thread is that counterinsurgency is sort of known as soft war or asymmetrical war or war by other means, if you will. And it is a political tool, and the basis of counterinsurgency coming, this is straight from the US Army Field Manual 3-24 on counterinsurgency. It has a whole field manual for its troops. And the definition of counterinsurgency in the Field Manual 3-24 is this: counterinsurgency is military, paramilitary, political, economic, psychological, and civic actions taken by a government to defeat insurgency. It declares that legitimacy is the main objective. So in counterinsurgency, war fighting is characterized pretty much by the same elements what we see as or could be termed as state building, or as I like to see it, is colonialism by other means. It's about establishing legitimacy, a control over a territory, and monopolizing violence. And so for this part of the series, I'm joined by my comrade Abby, and we're going to jump into a little bit of where counterinsurgency has been used. Thanks for joining us on Uprise Radio, Abby.
Happy to be here.
And Abby, could you talk a little bit about how counterinsurgency tactics, I mean, you know, we've read about counterinsurgency tactics in Algeria and against the FLN, and the French, I guess, is really trying, you know, the French is trying to re-establish its dominance as a colonial power during the Algerian War. And what came out of that was this kind of shifting of what we consider called modern warfare. And in fact, generals wrote a book about modern warfare and what that looks like, and shifting warfare away from the normal, like combat to combat, hand-to-hand combat between soldiers or fighters or guerrillas, and then became a shift onto the populations. And so that really, these ideas of counterinsurgency really emerged and were tested and tried and failed in Algeria by the French. But I'm just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, and also other examples where...
Well, I think the important thing to note is that counterinsurgency comes out of a reaction to the development of various guerrilla tactics implemented in the early 20th century in revolutionary and anti-colonial uprisings across the global south. These movements, whether they're in China, in what came to be known as Vietnam, or Algeria, were not fighting typical standing wars that the colonial governments were used to. Rather, they were also going from town to town, village to village, and implementing various social programs that built support for these guerrilla armies that were fighting against their colonial masters. And the colonial governments eventually realized that something very different was happening than what they were used to. They were used to fighting in trenches. And so they eventually came to realize that if there was this new form of what they called revolutionary warfare, there would have to be a counter-revolutionary warfare to respond to it. And so they essentially, especially in Algeria is where they began to develop these tactics, they co-opted a lot of the guerrilla strategies of building popular support, of acting not simply as offensive armies, but also as social groups, political groups that were looking to aid and help the general populace of the nations they were working in. And so the colonial armies responded by also implementing various social reforms and programs to address the underlying root causes that they saw of these uprisings. In the case of Algeria, they began to implement various social reforms, medical reforms, jobs programs to address the growing discontent of the Algerian people against their French rulers. In this way, they sought to paper over the inherent contradictions of their colonial societies and suck support away from the burgeoning guerrilla armies. So in this way, counterinsurgency is far more political than the typical run-and-gun approach to military strategy, in that they are not simply... The object of war is not just to fight and capture and kill the enemy, but also to sway public opinion and support in favour of the colonial armies rather than the guerrilla armies that were quickly building support.
So it really emerged out of this, I guess, in response to a movement towards decolonization across the global south. And I guess what has been, especially in the French case in Algeria, of trying to maintain a power which was kind of over the populations in Algeria, which has really racist overtones in the way that in which they saw people as not necessarily as politically engaged in order to be able to be easily swayed against these things. But in Zimbabwe, it was quite, I guess, you know, quite a decade after Algeria, these just showing how quickly these tactics are refined, and sort of seeing that, you know, in Algeria, the direct response to the FLN. And just one thing I want to remember, counterinsurgency movements also, whilst widespread, there's really not much of a metric in which to gauge their success whilst it's happening. So I guess in terms of analysing how those tactics are playing out within our movements, looking historically how they've played out. So, but they are also easy, you know, can be defeated and have really more commonly been defeated by this attempt at reinstituting imperial and colonial powers. But so following Algeria and moving on to somewhere like Zimbabwe, how had the counterinsurgency tactics by the British sort of shifted since the Algerian war?
Well, you can see the very quick development and the very quick sophistication that was built in counterinsurgency if you compare the Algerian experience to the Zimbabwean experience. Because the Zimbabwean counterinsurgency came to recognize that holding on to these colonial outposts as this kind of stratified racist society was becoming less and less possible in the typical colonial sense. And instead, it marked the shift towards neocolonialism, where there was a the various powers, such as the US, came to realize that there would have to be a indigenous leadership of these nations, whether it was Zimbabwe or Algeria or elsewhere, but that these leaders should be as favorable to US and imperialist interests as possible. And so in the case of Zimbabwe, they came to put their chips down with a man named Robert Mugabe and his party, the ZANUPF. Now, the reason for this was they saw a growing militancy among the rank and file guerrillas in the various guerrilla subsections of the Zimbabwean National Resistance and Movement for Liberation. And so they came to realize that these movements could only be pacified if they were in some ways given what they wanted, but this could be done in a way that would also favour what the US wanted as well. And so they came to realise they could exploit the class differences within these movements and favour the bourgeois and petty bourgeois leadership rather than the far more proletarianised rank and file that were a lot more radical. And by giving the power and handing over power to these quote-unquote respected leaders, the US interests in this region would still be respected. And so they came to lay their support with Mugabe and push towards his institution as the leader of Zimbabwe once the Rhodesia had fell. Therefore, they would be able to pacify the masses because they recognized that the masses' political grievances were valid, but that it could be portrayed in a way where they were given everything that they wanted, and yet they were not given the one thing they really wanted, which was liberation.
So as long as the flow of capital was able to continue and to be exploited by imperialist powers, they saw as an end point that the people would more support indigenous leadership in the form of Robert Mugabe. And there were, in Zimbabwe, there were direct attempts to disarm the guerrillas and to get them into, I guess, you know, native police forces and those sort of things that in order to increase patrols and unit patrols and within towns and villages and maintaining a presence, which we saw the US's policy in Iraq and Afghanistan was like kind of that constant, instead of having like these colonial military outposts of a foreign power, by instituting those patrols and those bases and integrating them within the villages in the hope that eventually the population would start to, one, feel more comfortable and see them as kind of altruistic and giving that, but it's never actually been altruistic. And I guess in a contemporary setting, the way we see that is like how the normalization of militarization, we see the military being brought into places like Mpwantwa, Alice Springs here, the military brought in for disaster relief when the government could, instead fund actual disaster relief, where most of really what that happens is by mutual aid and the communities themselves. So it's not really self-determination in terms of when you think about government from that place. It's still acting and a puppet government in the interests of US and imperialist capital.
Exactly, yeah. That's the entire shift towards neocolonialism focuses on having a indigenous face leading these nations but still operating within the interests of the larger imperialist structures, and most importantly opening up markets which would not be opened up if they were run under socialist or national isolationist policies.
Yeah, and so when we sort of fast forward, I mean, you know, this is... I guess Zimbabwe just following or in the midst of Cold War era counterinsurgency tactics, where you've got two, ideological powers essentially like fighting each other. Let's not forget also the nuclear power is like a pretty new technology of how that forms. And I guess this sort of focus on populations as a political space, and I guess for us and our movements, is understanding the deep inherent politics that is always in that. And actually, just to note, as Michael Evans, who was involved with quite closely with the British Army in Zimbabwe in disarming the guerrilla fighters and getting them into the Zimbabwean National Army during the 80s. And so just to give you a little bit of an outline of who Michael Evans is, Michael Evans is now considered one of the foremost experts on Australian Army counterinsurgent tactics, and was the lead author on the Australian Army's counterinsurgency tactics field guide manual, and has also like really stressed in his writing about counterinsurgency as a purely political tactic. And when Michael Evans speaks about the Australian Army's role in counterinsurgency, he really highlights and stresses that the Australian Army and the Australian Defence Force, by and large, is designed and should be designed for as an expeditionary force overseas. And so how we see that as being incongruent, I guess, with the Defence Force today and how it is, how defence and the build-up of sovereign defence capabilities for sovereign defence capabilities. One, on the one hand, you can see is this kind of like beating up of China as a perceived enemy in order to justify military spending in domestically, but also when you look at something like the main generals who are saying that Australian Army's role is not to be a domestic defence force, but is primarily as an expeditionary force, you see the incongruence there. And so it's pretty easy to paint a picture of when they talk about sovereign defence capability and building up sovereign defence capability here of and normalising and justifying that. It's pretty easy to see that this is for, one, for the flow of capital, of defence and weapons, to prop up the military, global military industrial complex, and for imperialist means and to maintain hegemony. And so it's pretty transparent when you kind of see the incongruence of how the government and through mechanisms and tools like the media, like school programs, trying to sell this to a population in order to justify this spending, which is a counterinsurgent tactic in itself, that incongruence with actually the Australian Army and Defence Force's strategic aims in theatres of war overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of times these military strategists and stuff are far more honest in their assessments than any of our politicians or anything, as they are the ones, they think they're talking amongst friends and are therefore very much willing to say things that politicians would never say out loud, such as our doctor friend we mentioned previously said, openly admitting that the Australian military is an expeditionary force. And so by reading these texts, these counterinsurgent manuals and stuff, we can have a far clearer picture of what their actual intentions are than any of the media releases or press statements that we get coming from politicians or extremely high-ranking military officials.
Yeah, and I think in for our movements, it's important to see that how these tactics work, because and not just jump, in a reactive way when the government implements a new policy like the Victorian government has, with banning face masks at protests and or anything that is designed for what they call disruption in the form of social cohesion. I just want to jump back quickly to a quote from the Rand Corporation, who have done a lot of the studies, disgusting people. But this is from a forum in 1962 from the Rand Corporation on counterinsurgency. And the quote here says, "The ideal allies for a government implementing control are in fact non-violent members of the community and would-be insurgents seek to mobilise. Strong moderate forces can be interlocutors to the community in general and an alternative for political action that does not involve violence. If moderates side with the government, they can provide superb intelligence on radical activities. If regimes can infiltrate or better yet cooperate with the mainstream groups, they are often able to gain information on radical activities and turn potential militants away from violence." And so one of the really main tactics, I guess, we see playing out here in counterinsurgent movements against our movement domestically is this what's called human terrain mapping. And we know this. We know that this is a tactic of the police, but this is also a military. This is fundamentally a military tactic of trying to figure out who interacts with who, how people interact. And I guess one of the ways in which we do respond collectively to that is to increase, I guess, our security and law, which is necessary in some regards. But I guess in this as being a political tactic, how can we overcome that repression rather than just constantly be responding to it in a practical or a technical sense? And I guess these are the questions that in the following weeks we want to create discussion around what that might look like, rather than being in a position of always just responding when these things happen, when the state uses repressionist tactics through things like the media. How do we respond to that in a proactive sense, rather than consistently being reactive to the tactics that they're employing, which we can learn about and understand and know about and be much better prepared and less vulnerable to state repression in that?
Yeah, Sakai, in a piece on movement security, in fact, discusses an idea that he has, that good security is simply good politics. And I think this is something that a lot of people overlook when getting bogged down into the details of being quote unquote secure, is that we cannot simply move reactively when we are facing these counterinsurgent threats from the state. We, by having a political line that is solid and that understands these threats from the go, we can avoid simply being reactive in these situations, because we need to understand that they are often many steps ahead of us. But by having a firm understanding of how they move through discussions like the ones we hope to provoke in this series, by understanding their methods, their tactics, the way they are applied all over the world, we can be far more ready to deal with these threats rather than simply reacting to them when they pop up unexpectedly.
Yeah, and I think that, that is also opens a space for creativity in the way that we respond. It's not just, I guess, fighting fire with fire, of looking at the tactics and then reacting and then moving from a place in which we are directly responding to those tactics as they are employed. But I guess, to start to think creatively about how we can go around them and actually politically defy and overcome that repression.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
This has been part one of what we're calling Missiles for the Masses. And this is part one in a series of programs looking at counterinsurgency, its history, and the tactics of counterinsurgency and militarism which were employed on the population and our movements domestically. This has been Uprise Radio on Community Radio Radical Radio 3CR. We will be back in a couple of weeks with part two.
With their strong arms locked to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back. Every day they're at the ready, the world's police. Restoring calm, maintaining order, keeping the peace. With their belts and badges and battles and boots in perfect array. Their uniformed bodies and disciplined minds trained to obey. And their strong arms locked to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back. Every day they're at the ready, the world's police. Restoring calm, maintaining order, keeping the peace. With their belts and badges and battles and boots in perfect array. Their disciplined bodies and uniform minds trained to obey. The order when it should come to use the gas that burns the eyes, the gas that chokes, the guns, the dogs, the water cannons, the rubber bullets to control the situation. And their strong arms locked to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back. Every day they're at the ready, the world's police. Restoring calm, maintaining order, keeping the peace. With their belts and badges and paddles and boots in perfect array. Their uniform, disciplined bodies and minds trained to obey. The order when it should come to use the gas that burns the eyes, the gas that chokes, the guns, the dogs, the water cannons, the rubber bullets, the plastic bullets.
The electrified barbed wire, the high velocity rifles. The submachine guns, the armoured cars, the tanks, the petroleum jelly, the fragmentation bombs, the high radiation bomb.
To control the situation. And their strong arms locked to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back. To hold back.
In the end, there is no holding back. A final calm descends upon the earth. All problems solved, a new order is born. With none of the messiness of birth. No trees sway out of line, there are no trees. No roses sprawl in riotous display, there are no roses. Nothing moves, no one stirs, no sounds of birds disturb the peace, there are no birds. And still they stand triumphant and immense, the silent lines of marble monuments. And soon the writhing seas will cease to rise, the flecks of grey ash float to rest, and there will be
perfect peace, complete calm. The maximum of order.
Every day they're at the ready, the world's police. Restoring calm, maintaining order, keeping the peace. With their strong arms locked to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back the mob, to hold back. To hold back. To hold back.